Good morning. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. The name of our show is Conversations. Conversations is a show where every week we talk to different folks from the area about different topics, rotating group of hosts, rotating group of guests. And today I'm excited to be talking with Chicago native and moved to Yuba, Joe Block. And Joe Block is, like I said, he's a Chicago native, business mogul, motorcycle enthusiast, international man of mystery. I have that.
Can't we just say a previous captain of industry?
Okay, a dominant captain of industry.
Yeah, yeah.
lived the big life, and now is retiring. Retiring? Is that what?
Well, I have retired. It's been 3 years now, Steve. Okay. Actually,
yeah. Well, great. Well, welcome to the show, Joe.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve.
Yeah, exciting to have you here. So, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about everything today. Like I said, I know Joe a little bit. Mm-hmm. We've gotten together at a few social occasions, did a little motorcycle riding together, and socially, I think your wife was out, and we walked around the Mississippi Valley
you,
land.
You hosted me at your place, which was very nice, and gave me a tour of
the Mississippi
Tunnelville Cliffs.
Yeah, Tunnelville Cliffs. Absolutely. Yeah. So, interesting guy. So, Joe, tell us, you are from Chicago, right?
I am originally from Chicago. I grew up actually in the north suburbs and then married my wife. And, well, I don't want to go back too long into my details and my history and my childhood. I don't think I don't think that's that exciting.
Okay.
But I met my wife at college at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and then she moved to Chicago. I was actually living in Northbrook at that time, a suburb of Chicago.
That's north side, isn't it?
North suburb.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we moved to Evanston in 1986, and we actually still have that house in Evanston, although we spend 80% of our time up here. So what else can I tell you? I worked with my family company from 1979 until I retired here in 2003. And we were a steel distributor called Block Steel Corporation.
Okay.
And my family, my grandfather and my father started that business in 1947-48, I believe. Kind of a little bit of a Horatio Alger story, if you're familiar with that term.
Yeah.
Literally had my grandfather, I believe, had a scrap cart, and in the post-World War II period would pick up scrap around the areas, bring it, you know, had a little yard that he leased or rented. I don't know all the exact details. And he would sort that scrap, and then just through a little bit of knowledge and knocking on doors in the post-World War II kind of boom, he would know manufacturers that could use certain aspects of that scrap after it had been sorted. And that just turned into a business, and essentially, as it grew. In the post-war years, post-World War II years, Chicago was, of course, a booming industrial city.
Sure.
And companies that were on the west side of Chicago, where we were located in Forest Park, included like General Electric, Hot Point, Sunbeam, which may not even mean much to people now, but at one time, Sunbeam was probably the premier appliance manufacturer. Right. And Zenith Electric, Zenith, which made television sets, and now we don't even think of steel in television sets, but when television sets were new, especially in the 50s and into the 60s, they had big steel chassis, and they actually used a lot of steel.
Okay.
So anyways, that business developed over the years and grew. And we built good relationships up with a lot of those companies that were on the west side of Chicago. At one point in the 60s, we started to see a product called aluminized steel, which is aluminum-coated sheet steel. It's commonly used historically in automotive exhaust systems, automotive heat shields. In more recent times, it's been used in gas-fired fireplaces. You know, a lot of people have gas-fired fireplaces these days, and a lot of new housing. You don't have fireplaces that are built out of stone anymore necessarily, or so you get these built-in fireboxes that come. Red companies and brand name like Heat-O-Late or Heat and Glow, Majestic was a brand name back in the day, and they're gas-fired with fake logs. You've probably seen them. That was a big user of aluminized steel, and probably still is. Besides for that, we also barbecues were a user of.
Sure.
So over, you know, as the 60s evolved, I was pretty young then. I was born in 55, but our company, you know, had built up a relationship with a steel company in Ohio called Armco Steel. They're in Middletown, Ohio. And we started to distribute that product a bit. We suddenly, moving through into the 70s and late 70s, when I became active, I started to help make the decision that should be our entire niche. In other words, Block Steel should focus really mainly on just doing aluminized steel. Because there weren't a lot of competitors that were doing that. Up to that point, we were kind of like carrying all different grades of what's called flat-rolled steel. I don't know how much you want me
to get
in.
Those are those big tubes that you see on the back of trucks sometimes?
Well, yeah, coils.
Coils, okay.
We'll call it coils.
Okay.
And that's thin steel rolled.
Right.
So it's pretty thin relatively. And those coils are what is the kind of the bread and butter of was our steel business. And that's called flat rolled steel.
Okay.
Steel that's produced and it's rolled out flat, even though it's coiled up.
Right.
But it's flat steel. As opposed to in the steel industry, a lot of people deal in structurals or rail or beams, which is a completely different niche of the steel industry.
Right. So you weren't actually producing it. That was made by this partner company in Ohio?
Right, or other companies.
Okay.
So basically we're middlemen,
right.
Distributors. So we would buy from the mills that produced the steel. We would inventory it. We did do some cold process, which is pretty critical. We can slit steel, which is where you take coils of steel that maybe are 48 inches wide or 60 inches wide, and you unroll those, send it through a bunch, set of roller knives, and then you would slit, the term is slit or cut, to narrower widths. So you might take a 60-inch wide coil and cut it to five cuts of 11.3. I don't know if my math was right there, but okay. I think you get the idea. And then those would be recoiled, and then you would have thinner coils, not thinner in gauge and thickness, but thinner in width.
Yeah.
And then those would go to a manufacturer who could use that specific width into a stamping press and stamp out parts.
Yeah, whatever machining they had available to make whatever they needed to make, right?
Correct. So that was one process. And the other process we would do would be to take those coils of steel and put it through what's called a leveling line. And that line would take the coils of steel, send it through some flatteners or a set of rolls, which would flatten the steel, take the bend out of it, and that would make sheets and then cut it into sheets. So we would take, for example, a 60-inch wide coil, send it through the leveler, and cut it to 120 inches, and you would be able to have a standard 60 by 120 sheet.
Sure.
And industry uses those standardized sheets pretty often in different applications also.
Right. And you had salespeople on the road that went out and they were calling on Weber and all these different companies?
We did.
Okay.
We did. And really, I did, when I got active in the company, I did a lot of the sales work myself.
Okay.
That's kind of, you know, a big part of the business.
And you were hitting the road, or this was
I would hit the road, yeah. I hit the road a lot, yeah.
And what was your range? I mean, was it Midwest?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As in the post-World War II period, of course, there was a lot of manufacturing in Chicago.
Right.
But as the moved into the 80s and into the 90s, and globalization started to take over, things started to really change. And our business became, when it was at one time 95% local to the Chicago area, I would say that by the time I retired in 2023, we were probably doing maybe 10 to 12% of business in the Chicago area, and the rest was national and to a degree international.
Oh, wow.
We had built up a very large, what do I want to say? Our niche was aluminized steel, as I said earlier, and we built up a reputation as one of the specialists in handling that material, not only in the country, but to a degree internationally. So when people needed that steel, that particular grade of steel, we would get the call. And we'd had contracts that were national in scope also. So we supplied a lot of customers, mostly east of the Rocky Mountains because of freight considerations and the cost of shipping. But we were selling, you know, to the Carolinas, to Georgia, to Florida, to the East Coast, the Midwest, Missouri, pretty much all over Minnesota, Wisconsin. Actually, right here in Viroqua, it was one of our bigger customers at one time, which is Nelson Muffler.
Yeah, Nelson.
For most of you that are familiar with them. And they are a large purchaser of aluminized steel.
And they're still going in nationally, Nelson Muffler?
As far as I know. Okay. I mean, like I said, I'm retired almost 2.5, 3 years
right
now. So I haven't really kept up with Nelson, but I'm assuming they're still doing what they do.
Right. And that, you know, from a supply and demand standpoint, the steel, and you're in it a good long time. So the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, was that pretty constant supply, or was there always like, oh, now we have too much, now we don't have enough?
Oh, yeah. That's always a huge problem with us. Because it's all about inventory management to a
right
degree. You do have some contracts, and so you have a steady understanding of what your sales is going to be. But a large percentage of our business was what we would call spot sales, where essentially somebody one day calls up and say, I need a truckload of this steel, and it might be someone you've never supplied before, or someone you've supplied 2 or 3 times in the past, and you had no projection that they were going to need this deal.
Right.
And that was pretty critical part of our business, but that's also part of the business that's a little more difficult to predict.
Right.
And that depends on economic conditions.
Yeah.
So we had our ups and downs, you know, over the years. We had a really bad time in the early 80s. When we did a big expansion in the early 80s, not too long after I started full-time, and we moved locations from Forest Park, which was on a west suburb of Chicago, to Skokie, Illinois, where we found a warehouse that was for sale and was a lot more convenient for us personally to get to. And we spent a lot of money in that move. And it really did not work out too well because within a year or two, for those of us that are old enough to remember, the prime rate, I believe, at one point in 1983, 84, was around 22 to 24%.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, today people talk about interest rates, but that was just astronomical.
Right.
So people that, you know, today, and put it in perspective, you might have a home equity loan or you might have a mortgage that's, what, 5 or 6%? I don't know what mortgages are now.
I think it's around 6, yeah.
Yeah. Back then, mortgages were like 18 to 20%.
Yeah. Right.
And it was a very crazy time. And that really hurt us because we went into debt pretty bad to this move. And it really affected us for the rest of my working career because we went from being a non-debt company to having a huge debt. But we survived.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, it was a rough, rough period then. But then, of course, we've had good periods, and wow, COVID was most recently, I hate to say this, because I know COVID affected a lot of people in a lot of negative ways. It was great for our business.
And why is that?
Well, we had record years, because for about a year, maybe a year and a half, people were not spending money on traveling anymore, right?
Okay.
They weren't going out to eat anymore. So what were people doing with their disposable income? They were buying new barbecues. They were buying new washing machines. They were buying new appliances for their house. And those markets were really going crazy. And whether it was by serendipity or design, I'd like to take credit by design, but there's
right.
a bit of serendipity.
It's all my idea.
Yeah, exactly. Take credit when, you know,
right.
things go good.
It doesn't come around often.
We had a really large inventory going into COVID.
Oh, wow.
We were probably over-inventoried going into COVID. And then COVID hit, and that was, like, incredible for us because for a while, some of the mills shut down. For a while, some other industries shut down. And supply chains got hugely disrupted. But within a month or two, people realized that there was still manufacturing going on and people wanted to buy stuff. And even though people weren't going out as much, there was a lot of activity in the consumer market. And we really prospered from that. And
cool.
pricing, we could just really, to a degree, set our pricing because we had the steel that people needed and they couldn't get it elsewhere.
Right. And you were talking about inventory, which was going to be my next question, was did you have to inventory a lot of this, or were you just moving it from the mill to the end user?
Oh, no, we inventory a lot. So at probably one point in time, I don't know, we probably inventoried as much as, I don't know, we had probably $25 to $30 million worth of steel in our inventory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the ticker's running on that at 20%,
yeah.
it's...
Right. Well, it's, interest rates eventually came
sure.
down, but... So yeah, that's kind of it. I mean, if you really want to distill the business that I was in, really just cut to the chase, it was really buy low and sell high.
Right. See what you could get. And as far as competition, let's just say in Chicago in the early days when it was mostly just whatever Chicago-based distribution, were there two other companies like you, or there are 200 other companies
yeah.
like you? You know, what was that like?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. The point you bring up is that, you know, we were a family company. And actually in the steel distribution business, coming out of World War II especially, there was a lot of family companies that were all in different niches of the steel industry. And a lot of independent companies developed over the years. And that was our comp. There was like, there was hundreds of competitors probably nationwide. There were definitely hundreds of competitors. But it was, of course, like any business, generally speaking, in capitalism, I guess if I can say that,
okay.
there always tends to be consolidation as time marches on. And when industries are in their sort of young years of an industry, there's a lot of competition. People want to get into it. But as businesses as industry matures, there's a lot of consolidation and people are buying up other people. And by the time I retired in 2023, there was much less competition, but the competition that was out there was much larger than we are. And they were international companies that were in the steel distribution network and had built up large national distribution chains.
Right.
And it was getting very difficult to compete in the markets.
Right. Wow. This is more intense than I thought it was going to be. I'm looking at our notes. We got to get into the International Man of Mystery part yet. We have to get into the Motorcycle Enthusiast part. But right now, we're going to take a break. We're 20 minutes in, and we're going to take a quick station break. You are listening to WDRT in Viroqua, 91.9 FM. Name of our show is Conversations. Today we're talking with Joe Block, and we're going to start talking about things other than steel right now. So hang on.
Well, good, Steve, because I'd like to get away from that. Okay. I'm retired.
We'll be right back. All right, we are back with Joe Block, Chicago native, steel guy.
Yeah.
And then steel guy moves to Yuba. Tell me about that. What were all the circumstances behind pulling the pin and getting a place in Yuba?
Sure. So being a Midwesterner and being in Chicago, you know, and a little bit of an enjoy of the outdoors, and especially when I was younger, a bit of a camping guy when I was younger. When you did take vacations or long weekends, where would you go? And, you know, a lot of people would go up to Devil's Lake from the Chicago area or somewhere in Wisconsin or, you know, Kettle Moraine, or a little farther afield, and would come up to what we now call the Driftless area. And we would take my wife and my family, and when we had our son, we would take camping trips up into the area, and I've always been interested in the Driftless area, not necessarily from a perspective of understanding the natural part of it, but I was always interested in it because of the transportation. I love the Mississippi River Valley. I'm a little bit of a railroad nut. You know, I'm kind of a guy, so I like machines. I love the river towns, and we would come up and we would camp. I remember we camped more than once, probably at Wyalusing, mm-hmm. and various places in the area, and just sort of fell in love with the area, not knowing as much about it as I do today, but just was always felt like a little bit of a special place.
And this was the 70s or 80s?
Yeah, late 70s into the 80s, into the early 90s, on and off. And then also being a motorcyclist, you know, for weekend trips or day trips up, you know, this was the area that was, you know, probably the closest to Chicago that really had the nicest riding, mm-hmm. For the most part. So fast forward, my father, who I was in business with, as I might have mentioned earlier, my father started the company, but he passed in 1996, okay. And I got a little bit of juice, so to speak, from that. And I said to my wife, you know, Debbie, I said, you know, we should look for a place. We got a little stash here. Let's look for a place up in that area. It would be really cool to have like a getaway place, and somewhere where I could ride my motorcycles and, you know, get out of the urban area. So we began, that was in the late 90s, and we began sort of a little bit of a search, and that was just pre-internet days. So we would look, that was the time period still where you would look in the classified ads of the Chicago Tribune, and they would have like vacation properties for sale in the Midwest and in the area, and we would look through those. And one day, an ad really piqued our interest, and I responded to the ad. And we thought it was a private seller, but it wasn't. It was a real estate agent who was listing it. And he sent us the listing, and it turned out we had no interest in what it was. It was, the description didn't really match what it was, but that was fine. And then it turned out that this real estate agent was a very aggressive guy, probably rightfully so. But he was the aggressive with the right temperament, and he never called us. But occasionally, he would send us envelopes of listings from the area, and we would get those periodically, and nothing ever really piqued our interest. We'd usually review those in the evening before we went to bed, and you know, we would look at them together and
dream
and look. But nothing ever really piqued our interest. And then over a year or two, he would keep sending questionnaires. Do you want me to keep sending you this and these listings? Am I wasting my time? And we said, no, keep sending them. And anyways, about two to three years after that process all started, we finally were laying in bed one night looking at these listings, and wow, this place looks really good. So we had been up in the area not too far from where our current house is, what we call Hidden Acres today, on one of our sort of camping trips, or we had been around. And we ended up contacting the realtor, telling him that, yeah, we're interested in this. We took a day and we drove up, met him at the property, not knowing what to expect. And this is, you know, we're still city people. I'm not really a rural person, don't really understand the ways and means of the rural lifestyle too much. And we get up here not curious about, you know, what's going on. And the property was gorgeous. We thought it was just fantastic. The house was a work in progress. It was a sturdy house built in, I think it was built in 1907, but it's a formed concrete block farmhouse. And the land was gorgeous. We walked the land. In fact, I made the realtor walk the land. But I'll talk about the land in a second, because the land really wasn't gorgeous. It was gorgeous from a city person's perspective, but it was filled with virtually everything non-native. Multiflora rose, right? Autumn olive. It was really trashed, but we didn't know that.
Was it farmed hard?
It was farmed hard at one time, yes. It was farmed hard. But we fell in love, and it turns out that, surprise, surprise, the people that were selling were a gay couple, two men who were breaking up. And that sort of surprised us a little bit. We're used to that, of course, in Chicago, but we were a little surprised to see this rural. And we hit it off really well with one of the guys. The one guy didn't want to sell, and he wasn't happy about us being there, and he was grouchy. And anyways, we walked the property that day. We loved it. I didn't know my wife loved it, and we were kind of driving out of the driveway to head back to Chicago. And I kind of sheepishly turned to Debbie and I said, "What do you think?" And she goes, "Oh my God, it's great." So that sealed the deal.
Right.
The next morning, we made an offer. The offer was accepted. The rest is sort of history. We've then just got really lucky in a number of aspects because the house was down to the studs and needed to be finished off. But we didn't know anybody really up here who would do the work, and I'm not capable of doing the work myself. And plus, I was still working in the steel business at the time, and my wife is a social worker. So we were just coming up on weekends at that time. The house was livable, but really needed to be finished off.
And this is what year again did you say?
Oh, this was, I'm sorry, 2001.
Okay.
2001.
Sure.
Yeah, right after September 11th, actually, is when we closed. Right around there. That was 2001, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So then, especially my wife, Debbie, and me more so, me more a little bit less so, I was more interested in getting all my motorcycles up there and doing some riding. But I was also interested in the land, and Debbie was interested in the land. And we started to do a lot of research about what was on our property. And we also started to do some research on locals on who could help us finish off the place. And we had a connection with, if I don't mind mentioning his name, with Joe Schwarty, a furniture maker down in Gay's Mills, you know, fantastic sure. artisan.
Chicago guy.
Chicago too. Guy who moved up, you know, to Gay's Mills. And he, through connections through him and word of mouth, we found out about Dan Arnold and Steve Christensen, who were working together at the time. And we hit it off with them. And we managed to connect with them, and we ended up building up a really good relationship. And they came in and they sort of finished off the work on the property. Tremendous job, really.
Right.
We gave them, to a degree, a little bit of carte blanche. They could do what they wanted while we were gone. We didn't really oversee them. We trusted them, and our trust was rewarded. Because their craftsmanship and the work that they did was pretty incredible.
Right.
And then on the other side of the natural part of it, as we got more interested, we had people walk the land with us. One of the people that we got to call out to walk the land with us was a probably well-known gentleman by Neil Diebold. He's well known in Wisconsin as a naturalist, I believe.
Okay.
Probably a prairie expert, I think. I can't remember exactly. I think he had a public radio show at one time. I'm not really sure. But he came out and walked the land for us, and we learned a lot. And we learned how trashed our land was. But we also learned that we had a lot of aspects. We have an oak savanna remnant. We have some of a fen. We knew we had springs, so we have a lot of natural aspects to our property that are pretty special. It was really, again, back to the word serendipity. It was pretty serendipitous because we were not completely aware of all these details when we purchased the property. Mm-hmm. And especially knowing about the oak savanna, although it had been heavily grazed, it was still a magical little hilltop that we had. And that really spurred us, especially my wife, into doing more and more. And then my wife got really into prairie restorations. And so we cleared off as much of the land as we could and tried to bring back whatever would be considered like native vegetation, native landscape, native prairies. And we've been working on that for the last 25 years.
And cleared land by bushwhacking it?
Yes.
Chainsawing
or, you know, not so much the woodlands, but what we had, which was the scrub areas, right. The multiflora rows. And so we did that with forestry mowing and burns,
Okay. Basically,
over the years. Wow. We've done a lot of burns. And the transformational landscape has really been pretty special.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say enough about the work that my wife has done in working towards that. And, of course, it became one of her passions in life. And she actually then, you know, eventually got involved with the Prairie Enthusiasts up here and got involved with the board of the Prairie Enthusiasts. And that's become, although I'm a little bit peripheral to that, I do help some of the mowing and
Right. Some
of the land work. And I would like to take a little bit of credit for it, a little bit of financial assistance there.
Sure.
But that's been a great thing. So we have kind of a Hidden Acres has become a pretty special property.
Right. And I think you said fent before?
Fen.
What is
we
that?
We have a sloping fen.
What is that?
A sloping fen is actually like almost like a spring, but it doesn't really fully run. It's where the water is sort of like the ground is always wet.
Okay.
But it doesn't actually, it's not really a full spring. It's like an area.
Right.
And so because of that, the vegetation is a little bit different in that fen area, and it's kind of a unique landscape.
Sure. And the other thing we didn't do is Yuba. We didn't say where Yuba was because not everybody knows. Where is Yuba?
Yuba is about halfway between Hillsboro and Richland Center, approximately 15 miles from Richland Center. Actually, Yuba's kind of 15 miles from a bunch of metropolises. It's about 15 miles from Richland Center, approximately, about 15 miles from Cazenovia, about 15 miles from Hillsborough, and about 16 or 17 miles from Lafarge.
Okay.
So those yeah.
Yeah, and the Driftless Music Grounds are close by?
Driftless Music Gardens are outside of Yuba, yes. Right. Of course, that's a relatively new development since we've been there last, 8 years or whatever.
Right.
That's a fantastic place.
Sure. How big is Yuba?
Yuba, right now, I believe the signs say population 91.
Okay.
When we moved there, the population, I believe, was 77 or 71 right. on the road signs.
Sure.
And Yuba, when we first moved up there in the area, Yuba had three taverns for a population of 71 people, kind of a quintessential Wisconsin tavern town.
Right.
Unfortunately, Tiny, who had one of the taverns in town, passed in the, I don't know what year he passed, I can't remember now, but and Tiny's closed.
Okay.
So now there's only two taverns.
Two taverns.
In town. Yeah.
And Yuba's kind of famous for their three-day dance. Do you know anything about that?
Or? I do. You know, I do. I have a little thumbnail knowledge okay. of it. Yuba is a really fascinating little town. Yuba was settled mainly in the area, was in Hillsborough, too, to agree, but was Czechs and Bohemians
right.
and, you know, Catholic for the most part. That's a bit of a stereotype, not entirely, but
right.
generally. And I think it's okay to make generalizations a little bit in that type of aspect. So a lot of Czech Bohemians, and Czech Bohemians like to drink. I will sort of say that historically.
The Czech Pilsner.
The Czech Pilsner, right. They're drinkers. And I don't know the total history of the Opera House, but what is now the building where the bar called The Still is the upstairs that is actually the old Yuba Opera House. And there would be, you know, music up there and dances and stage. But what we call Mardi Gras today was actually the same time frame for what became, I believe, the three-day dance. That's after Lent, am mm-hmm. I correct?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not an expert.
You're not a Lent specialist?
I'm not a Lent specialist. I'm not a religious, I'm not a theological
okay.
expert. So
we'll just go with what we're thinking is right.
But I believe that after Lent is when Mardi Gras, or Mardi Gras is just before Lent, whatever.
Okay.
And so Yuba became very famous for its three-day dance, where really it was like a big party all weekend. And I guess it was really wild for many, many decades. It was kind of a thing. I know when we moved up here, it was still, there were remnants of it. And to this day, there are still remnants. So if you go to The Still today, on that weekend, there will be music. And in fact, the new owners of The Still, who are our neighbors, some of which are our neighbors, have done a great job, and they've really rehabbing the building, and have rehabbed a bit the Opera House upstairs. And I recommend anyone who gets to Yuba, check out The Still and ask them if you can walk upstairs to see the old Opera House, because it's pretty cool.
Well, I think, you know, to put yourself in the mindset of the time, you know, whatever, 1900 or 1870 or, you know, that sort of thing. Just before, you said you're 15 miles from Hillsborough, 15 miles from Richland Center, whatever, 18 miles from Lafarge. That's a long ways to go when you're on a horse and cart.
Well, true.
You know,
But the thing is, Yuba used to be a lot bigger. Yuba was a pretty thriving town at one time. Mm-hmm. There was a post office, you know, hardware store, feed mill, right, the whole nine
retail.
Yards. I think one of the things that may have been part of the death, well, I won't say death knell, because Yuba certainly survives
mm-hmm.
and it has a great culture around it and great people around it. At least I think so.
Right.
Highway 80 used to go through Yuba. So from Richland Center to Hillsborough, the main highway was 80, and that went right through Yuba.
Okay.
I don't know what year. I think it was the late 80s, early 90s, when the reorientation of Highway 80 took place. and they cut straight up through the topography, sort of more in a straight shot from Richland Center to Hillsboro. And the road to Yuba got downgraded to an alphabet road, and it's now C, right. Alphabet Road C. But I think that kind of hurt it a little bit. And I think just part of, you know, how things change over time.
Sure.
It's hard to keep some small towns going.
Yeah. Well, and that's a story that's told many times, like where does the railroad go through? That could
exactly.
make or break your town, you know, and the same way with the highway. But Yuba is, I mean, just take a ride out to Yuba, take a drive through, take a walk through. They have a great little community center downtown.
They do.
And they have the history of Yuba on the walls from old newspaper clippings and things like that. If it's open, I know we were there for a high school graduation party for one of my wife's students at the time, and it's just a cool town. I mean, if you walk through town and your mind just wanders.
Yeah, it is. And there's been a great little book that's been published about Yuba that you might be able to find probably at one of the local libraries, or they probably keep a copy there at the community
right.
center. And I would recommend anybody take a look and review that, because it's worth looking at.
Right. Well, cool. Again, we're talking with Joe Block today. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. The name of our show is Conversations. I'm your host today. My name is Steve Brandl. You're listening to us on Thursday morning. If you're listening on the radio, this show is every Thursday morning at 9 o'clock with a rotating group of conversations. And if you want to hear this again or share it with a friend, please go to wdrt.org. Go to Conversations in the Archives. You can find this show and literally hundreds of other great shows from other artists, both music and talk radio. So now WDRT has an app as well, so spend more time supporting WDRT and listen in. We're going to be right back. Right. We're back with Joe Block, and we talked about the steel industry. We talked about Yuba.
We did.
And now we're going to talk about motorcycling fun. So tell us about that, Joe. How did you develop your...
Well, like a lot of kids, I guess, a lot of boy kids, maybe women kids too, or women, girl kids, whatever. A lot of human kids
right.
get interested in mechanical things at a young age. And I was always a little bit of a motorhead. And, you know, when I got into my adolescent teen years, always was reading motorcycle magazines or car magazines
right.
or whatever it would be. And I had a special passion, of course, for motorcycles. You know, my parents did not approve. We lived in the suburbs of Chicago, and my parents did not share that passion. My group of friends got really obsessed with it, and we got mini bikes.
Sure.
Which, you know, today mini bikes are a little bit different, but back then mini bikes were really kind of outlaw-ish, especially in the suburbs. And, you know, you weren't allowed to ride on the street or any of that, and there was no real land anywhere to ride, but you'd ride on the street anyways, and you would be, you know, outlaws. And mini bikes, we had lawnmower engines and were pretty rudimentary. And but it was a passion. And you know, I can remember in 1969 when Easy Rider came out, we took our mini bikes to the Forest Preserve and made a Super 8 film. We were about 14 years old at the time, and made our own film called Junior Sleazy Riders, which I might add I still have on Super 8 film reel.
Right.
And someday if I get my act together, I'm going to transfer those to video so the world can actually
see YouTube?
It.
You're going to YouTube it?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Is it not... Yeah.
I'm pretty far behind in archiving all that stuff. So anyways, I've always had a passion for two wheels, four wheels too, but for two wheels. When I had the opportunity, when I got away from home, when I went to college, I got my first motorcycle.
Which was?
A Honda 400 for a 1976.
Kind of a classic.
They are sort of classic now. Yeah. Great motorcycle. Loved that motorcycle. And then I kind of graduated a little bit. I traded that in for a year or two later for a 1973 BMW R75/5, which has also become a classic bike. I don't still have it. I kind of wish I would have held on to that. And I had that throughout my most of my college years. And then when I moved back to Chicago and got involved with the company, had a little bit of money, my passion started to grow. I picked up an Ariel Square 4. My first classic bike, which I still have. That's a British bike. And then I just, over the years, started getting other motorcycles as they came in. And some motorcycles came in. Some motorcycles got sold. The collection changed, but my passion remained. And over the years, I built up a little bit of collection, and I have... I think I have 14 motorcycles now. Yeah.
And you keep them all running?
I keep them all running. Actually, one of my bikes right now, my 37 Velo set, is not currently running. I have a little bit of clutch issue with that, but that's a project that I hope to kind of get it sorted out sooner rather than later.
Right. And how often do you get on them? Are you out a couple times a week?
Or? Oh, easily. I'd say just about in the summertime, pretty much close to every day if the weather contributes. So, you know, that's my passion. Mm-hmm. As I said, my wife's passion is the land, pretty much. My passion is motorcycles. But I also do a lot of wrenching. I'm not a great mechanic, but I can get things done and I can fix things to a degree.
Sure.
I'm not a machinist, but... I can do basic repairs, and I can do basic deduction of things that go wrong and, you know, get things running again.
Right. And there's a ton of motorcycle clubs around, you know, like the BMW group and the Moto Guzzi group, and I bet they love coming up to the drift list.
They do. They do. And, you know, I've been over the years being into motorcycling, probably a little bit like you, Steve, because there's a shared passion, you end up just meeting a lot of people. Anybody that's in a subculture that focuses on that subculture, if you have any kind of degree of social networking, you tend to meet other like-minded people. And so over the years, especially both in Chicago and up here, you know, I've become part of motorcycle culture to a degree, and I know a lot of people involved with motorcycling. And, yeah, it's great. You know, like just yesterday, I took a long ride with a lot of Guzzi guys. There's kind of a strong Wisconsin Guzzi, Moto Guzzi contingent.
Okay.
Yeah, and like you said, the BMW folks, and it's a real passion of mine that I really enjoy. I mean, motorcycling is for those of us that enjoy it and understand it, it's really something special. It's it allows you to be outside of nature, but in nature at the same time, so to put it, right? I mean, you're burning fossil fuels.
Right.
You may not be environmentally the best thing in the world to do, but it brings great pleasure, at least, and you do get to see the world that I think from a perspective that other people don't see it in.
Sure. And I think it's such an, you have to be so engaged when you're riding a motorcycle and so aware of everything that's going on around you that is part of the addiction almost.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Especially when you have a passion like I do, or I believe you do, where you take it really seriously, and motorcycling is... Mm-hmm. More than just recreation, but it's really almost like a passion, and it takes a lot of focus, and it takes a lot of work, but it's quite enjoyable.
Right, right. Well, and the folks that come up, so I know you put together different tours or whatever, maybe they just lean on you for the good route when they do come up.
Yeah, to a degree. I've supported a thing. There's a group that comes up here that I only am peripheral to, but I try to support in the fall, called TWALT, a bunch of people from Chicago. That stands for the weekend after Labor Day. And I usually have a lunch for those folks.
Okay.
They rent like motels, usually around Boscobel or sometimes in Viroqua. And there's a big group of people from Milwaukee and Chicago that contribute to that. I try to contribute to that. So there's a bunch of events. And In fact, Steve, there's an event that's coming up soon that happens on the third weekend of July, always on the Saturday of July, called Lorem Ipsum. Well, have you heard of that event?
I have heard of that. Lorem Ipsum, tell us the origin of that name and of the show.
Yeah,
itself.
Well, there's a gentleman here in Viroqua by the name of Mike Coppa, which I think a lot of our listeners may be familiar with. I think he's probably a little bit more of a friend of yours than he is of mine, although he's become, I think, a pretty good friend. Mike's a very interesting character, and years ago, I believe it was 15 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
He started this event called Lorem Ipsum Old Motorcycle Picnic, or Vintage Motorcycle Picnic. And his idea was to get like-minded people who are interested in old motorcycles together for a lunch on a low-key event outside Driftless Books behind the tobacco warehouses here in Viroqua. And Mike, I believe you may have even helped him organize it, would, do a barbecue, grill some brats, have some special fermented vegetables, maybe some tinned fish, I believe,
right.
Mike is into.
All the finest fare.
All the finest fare, very low key, and just invite people to hang out for a couple of hours, have a bite of lunch, perhaps, talk motorcycles, and then go riding. A daytime event, not necessarily what people, the general public, think of as, kind of a biker thing,
right,
with black leather and black t-shirts, although we have black t-shirts, but not necessarily a loud, event, but a kind of a laid-back event that attracted a very diverse group of motorcyclists.
Right.
And I think it was really, Mike did a great job, is really successful. Mike is also a really good design guy. And he's the one who's done a lot of swag over the years, if I can use that term, stickers. I believe Mike was the one who sort of really began, you might correct me, Steve, you might know more than I, but he's the one who sort of like really started the Driftless bumper stickers. Or the Driftless stickers that
we
see?
Yeah, I mean, I think the marketing end of it, a big portion of it is, when you see just the Driftless sticker, and you see it everywhere now.
Right, correct.
That's Mike's, that's from the mind of Mike Coppa.
Correct.
Right.
And he's also really good at design, so he's designed T-shirts for us over the years and put his stamp, his eclectic stamp, right, on Lorem Ipsum. And Lorem Ipsum, I think, is a very eclectic motorcycle gathering.
Yes, it is.
Where everyone is welcome, even if you don't have a motorcycle, just to gather. It's really a social event that I think anybody could enjoy just to get together.
Sure. And for years and years, it was held in Viroqua, but this year?
Correct. So it was always held in Viroqua, in front of the, behind the tobacco warehouses, right, in front of Driftless Books, which I happen to really enjoy, because we all know that Driftless Books is like one of the most special places, not only in the Driftless, but really in the world. I mean, Eddie Nix is just an incredible,
right,
human, and an incredible place that everybody should get to at least once,
right,
in their life. But I guess Mike Coppa, who's really the main organizer of this, decided that he didn't want to do it anymore, or at least he didn't want to take responsibility, and he wanted to just go ride himself.
Right.
So he had an idea of moving Lorem Ipsum around. We tried a couple of venues. We're thinking about Steuben. And I put a little pressure on Mike, and I said, Mike, why don't you just let me sort of take a little bit of reins here. You can back off, and we'll have it in Yuba. Yuba's a great town. You don't have to do anything except come and ride, and we don't have to do anything. There's a bar called The Still that serves lunch if people want. We don't have to grill brats. People can go into The Still and get lunch if they want. And Yuba would be very welcoming. And Mike agreed. And so the transition has been made. Lorem Ipsum, in this year of 2026, will be in Yuba on the third Saturday in July.
Yeah, Saturday of July. That's July 18th.
This year, yes.
And that's from what? From about 11 to?
From about 11 to 1:30 is what we call it. It's a low-key event. I might add that even though The Still is there, we don't regulate what anybody wants to do. We don't encourage alcohol
right.
consumption. That's not the point of this rally.
Right.
But everyone's welcome, and The Still is very happy to have us and serving lunch. And people don't have to drink alcohol,
right.
of course. They can get whatever they
want.
And
there's no admission? This is just
there's
come.
No admission.
See
just
Yuba.
Come. Yep. And we'd prefer people bring their old motorcycles. The older, the better. But everyone is welcome, and every motorcyclist is welcome. And the public in general is welcome to come gawk and walk around and talk.
Right. So if you're interested in talking to old guys on old motorcycles and
right.
that sort of thing, it's the place to be.
But, Steve, we have to catch ourselves a little bit. There's a lot of women now, especially now, that are involved with motorcycling. So I'd like to think and I like to hope the word has gotten out, and it won't be just old guys, that there will be some women there and younger people and
right.
younger guys and younger women.
Right. And
yeah.
there's a whole lot of people that have experience that would love to talk to you about motorcycles, motorcycling. How do you get started? What's the right way to do it? You know,
exactly.
how big of a bike do I get? Who
exactly.
do I talk to?
Exactly.
Because there's an easy entry point to motorcycling.
Yes.
And there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot of people out there that will support you and help you.
Absolutely. And this historically has been a really good group, people that have showed up that have a lot of knowledge. People with a lot more even knowledge, for sure, more than I have about motorcycles and mechanics. And anybody who's interested at all peripherally should try and make it.
Right. Well, Joe, we certainly thank you for jumping on one of your motorcycles and coming into
sure.
WDRT this morning. Thanks a million. And for everyone listening, thanks for supporting WDRT 91.9 FM again. The name of our show is Conversations, and we hope to have you listen in again next week. Thanks for listening today.